All right, welcome back to Tuxedo Time.
Oh my God.
Welcome back to another episode of Tuxedo Time, where we are Tuxedos in a Time, podcast edition, after show edition. So we kind of did last week, or 2 weeks ago, however long we decided to separate this. We were going to do an after show edition for Bluebird, our short film, which if you missed it and you missed last podcast, briefly, it's a snowmobiling trip that we took in our home province of Newfoundland. We basically decided we want to change our relationship with wintertime and do a fun excursion we'd never done before, and that was a snowmobiling trip. And we kind of weaved in an old childhood friend, Lewis, and he was our guide. And it was a really fun way to kind of introduce you guys to him and kind of the trials and tribulations of us trying to make it to a very scenic outlook that we've been really wanting to get to for a long time. And you'll have to watch the video to see if we made it or not, because it is a bit of an epic journey.
It's definitely an epic journey. It definitely did not go as we planned originally.
Yes.
But, you know, every good adventure always has a alternate kind of story or some story arcs,
every
right?
Good adventure has misadventure.
Ooh, so, I love that. Good adventure has misadventure. I think that's the title for the podcast.
There you go. You heard it right now. You heard it right here.
You did a really good job.
That's a Chris Nicholas original right there.
Despite messing up the intro, you did a really good job.
Well, you know what? That's called regression towards the mean. Anyway, so last week we were supposed to do an after show edition last week, and we ended up basically answering one question and went on a complete tangent about the economics of YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, I think it needed to be talked about. Sometimes we just got to let it rip.
Yeah.
Like, so if you have something to talk about, you got to let it rip.
That one question was, how do you guys pay for these trips? And we kind of went into it and talked about how these are funded. And if that's a burning question for you guys, how do you guys fund flying a helicopter across the country? Or how do you guys fund doing an epic 3-day snowmobiling trip in Newfoundland? Check that episode. We'll leave a link in the show notes below.
We didn't talk about how much those trips cost.
Yeah, that's true. But they're different costs for every trip.
Yeah.
Either way, they're
at least $10,000 each.
At least.
At least.
Today's episode is not about the economics of how to have a YouTube channel. Today's podcast is more so focusing on the actual trip of Bluebird and some behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, some of the more like production kind of stuff. So when we were going into, first of all, let's just say we shot this film in March of 2023.
Right. And we sat on it basically for better part of a year.
We sat on it because I didn't want to put out a winter themed video in the summer.
Right. Cause we filmed it almost beginning of spring, late winter, early spring.
I mean, it was starting to be spring in Buffalo.
Yeah.
It was probably starting to be spring everywhere outside of Newfoundland.
True.
So we decided to sleep on it, but I basically rough cut it and then set it aside. And then we went into heading west until basically November, because it didn't make sense to put up winter themed video in the summertime. And I wanted to save it for winter to inspire people to change their perspective on winter and get out there and, you know, experience the winter and not, you know, be sad and down because the weather sucks for 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. And I think that was a nice way to do it. It was probably not what most YouTubers would do.
Well, I definitely not sure if I would post another hardcore video like that during that week of Christmas.
Yeah, but also like, that's the thing, right? Is December 29th was when it was released.
Yeah.
Which was a Friday.
Right.
I was at work on Friday during the premiere.
Yeah. I mean, it was slow going, but it
picked up. Much of our audience was at work too.
Yeah. It picked up on Saturday and Sunday, and there's a significant jump there, which I don't have any regrets.
Right.
Actually.
But you're also not going to post it. And like, normally we post our videos on Sundays.
Yeah.
You're not going to wait till Sunday on a holiday weekend, which would have been what? Christmas Eve?
New Year's Eve.
Oh wait, New Year's Eve. Sorry. Yeah. So it's like, you're not going to post a video on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Like that's not going to either do well either. So I think that initially the views kind of lagged because not many people they're going to see 49 minute video when they're at work and they're like, oh, I'm not going to watch that.
Yeah.
But then the views picked up like 24 hours later, the line was back into like the middle of our average views. So
yeah,
it worked out, but I wouldn't put too much stock in the performance just based on posting it over the holiday weekend.
The funny thing about the performance of the films in the series is that like I have so much fun and they're so fulfilling that I just don't really care.
Yeah.
Whereas like the other videos that I feel like are made for more searchable stuff, like I care more on whether they perform or not.
You also have a weird thing but it's like if you have a sponsored video.
Yeah.
Where your livelihood is tied to that, you want that to do better numbers. Ironically, because...
Well, because they have faith in you, right? And they paid for it.
Right. Because there's been money exchanging hands. Yeah. So you want to feel like a sponsor got their value.
Yeah, but you also can't look at the value in the first week of that video. You really have to go back and look at it over the last 6 months.
Right.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Bluebird, the film. It is really difficult to film something and then sit on it and then pick it back up 6 or 7 months later. But I was really excited and motivated because I feel like the story was pretty interesting. I did a lot of pre-production ahead of time. We were actually planning this trip for 2 or 3 years. We were going to do it in 2020, obviously. We all know what happened. And then we just didn't. And then finally we were like, okay, like, let's make it happen. March 2023. So I did a bunch of pre-production and basically said, like, this is what the story is going to be. I know there's going to be highs and lows. So like, this might be a low point or this might be a high point, just kind of like laying it out in my head, but not really obviously saying, oh, this is going to be a drama. We're going to make this drama. It's just kind of like, this is what's going to happen. Like, there could be drama getting to Newfoundland. There could be drama getting this car. There could be drama getting to lose. There could be drama with the sleds, you know, but like, you don't really know until it's actually happening. So I basically planned it all out, made this whole graph of what the story was going to be in case nothing happened. And that's something I do all the time. I did it with Heading West as well. Plan out what the story is, what the concept is, and then whatever happens, happens. If nothing happens, then you have a story. If a bunch of things happen, then you have an even better story. And a bunch of things happen and we had an even better story.
Yeah. So how much of what plot points or what parts of the story were completely spontaneous and not planned for?
The entire thing with the rental sled was not planned. The overheating, not planned.
We shouldn't say planned.
Because
it's like an unforeseen, maybe. Better.
Unforeseen. Yeah, unforeseen. So I think going into it, we had planned that, you know, we were going to pick up Lewis, get to the West Coast, get on the sleds and make it to the gorge. And for me, I think it was like the weather is the only thing that's in the way. If we get a good day, we're going to get to the gorge. What was unforeseen was all of the things that led up to us, spoiler alert, not making it to the gorge on that first day. Mm-hmm. So you really had to watch the film to really understand this podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously we got to the west coast of the island after picking up Lewis in the center part of the island. And this snowmobile trip took place on the west coast near Gros Morne National Park. We didn't actually make it into the park. But Lou had lined up for us to use his sled, which was a Ski-Doo Expedition, I believe. And then he borrowed his buddy's high performance Ski-Doo, which was a free ride. So it's like a super high performance,
a mountain sled.
Of course, like, you can't really predict what the conditions were going to be. Like, right. We could have gone out there and there could have been no snow. We could have gone out there and it could have been perfect.
We went Ski-Dooing and there's no snow.
We went out there and the conditions were ice, basically. And so we went for a trial run and a bunch of things kind of led up. There's actually more things that led up to the issue than what we actually put in the video. So when we got there on the first night, we were supposed to get on the sleds to go out for our test run, but we wanted to interview Lou first. So we interviewed Lou. That took about an hour by the time we set up, sat down with him, got him used to the camera, did the interview. That took about an hour. Then by the time we got on the sleds and we got to the gas station was closed. So had we not done the interview, the gas station wouldn't have been closed and we would have had the gas and we would have known that they didn't have park passes.
Right, so, but I don't think that would have ultimately changed things.
It wouldn't have, but it was just one of those other things that just kind of like made pushed everything a little bit later, right?
And they can watch the full film to appreciate all of the small little setbacks that we encountered that ultimately ended up in us not necessarily having the outcome we intended.
Right.
But as far as like not just the foreseen versus unforeseen difficulties, after, say, you interviewed Lou and after the trip was all done, what parts of the story emerged to you that you weren't planning on telling?
The whole BMX thing. Originally, the story was supposed to be about changing your mindset about winter. I realized, like, our audience does not know Lou. We have to introduce Lewis to our audience, make them like him, and then form a connection between Lou and Chris. Suddenly, there was a story about your past and BMX and your relationship with Lewis that blossomed up that was not planned.
And it just there's no interview questions really, other than like, how do you guys know each other? Because that was like the natural question to ask.
Right. And so during the interview, when we asked Lou, like, how did you guys meet? And he said from BMX riding, then we were like, oh, that's like, let's poke a couple more questions. Like, can you tell us more about that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the interesting thing about when you're like interviewing somebody, it's like listening to their answers and then like thinking about what could be a good story thread. So I wasn't expecting that to happen. So when I got back and I started editing his voiceover, I was like, oh my God, like not only is like this really interesting, but it's really cool to show like this background of you, Chris, like that our audience has never seen.
And also helps that, you know, the year is, the range of years is 1999 to 2006.
Yeah.
And we have like video footage of all
we
of that.
We do, yeah. Thank God you put all of those videos on Facebook. I ripped them off Facebook.
So low quality.
They are, but they worked out perfectly. So that was definitely a story thread that I wasn't expecting. And it just so naturally happened. Like there was a bunch of references because you and Lou were such close friends and that was the relationship that you had was riding BMX. There were all these like little threads that happened during filming that kind of threw back to that moment. And I didn't really realize it until after I started editing. And I was like, oh my God, wait now. He said, oh no, you're not going to get hurt because there's no handrails. And then like
that was an inside joke that you're able to now have the audience in on because we explained what a handrail was.
Exactly.
And how you grind them on BMX bikes, you know?
Right. So had I not dove into that side of it, that kind of like inside joke wouldn't have made sense to anybody.
And I still probably think that it went over a lot of people's heads.
Probably. But to me, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, this is a piece of the story that ties into the intro of this. And so like, what do I need to explain at the beginning of this video for this kind of joke to land?
Right. And the funny thing was, is that he said that comment before we even did the interview.
Yeah.
Like that was just him laughing at me because he knows that I got wrecked on handrails all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It just kind of goes to show like the relationship you guys had, right? And how close you are. Yeah. None of the things that like happened were scripted. Everything was just like, we're filming what we're doing. Right. I had questions for Lou. Lou didn't read off a paper. He just talked. Same with your interview. It was a little bit different because I had the framework of the story. And so I knew like, oh, there was this joke about handrails and Lou was talking about how you guys met. And so like, can you tell me more about how you met? And then can you talk about how you were getting hurt?
Right.
And then you getting hurt came up again. Like when we picked up Lou and you're like, I'm really afraid I'm gonna get hurt. And he said, there's no handrails. You're going to be okay. And then when you rode his free ride a little bit later in the film, it kind of was a little bit of the throwback to that, like Daredevil Chris Nicholas of like, you know, just jumping on a high performance sled with no experience and like trying to do wheelies and doing tricks and things. Right. So
classic Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah. And then there was like a little bit of like, you know, nostalgia there where you guys were talking about, you know, how the tables have kind of turned between you being able to do all the crazy tricks and Lou being jealous. And now like Lou can do all these tricks and you're jealous kind of thing.
Yeah. Jealous, quote unquote.
Like, not actual jealousy, but like,
yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, of course, tying the end thoughts up at the end of, you know, the way you guys felt during your childhood about the winter time and the relationship between BMX and the winter.
That's a good point. Cause that was sort of an afterthought and I didn't realize it until we were kind of doing that interview at the end that like we started with the BMX, both Lou and I and all the rest of our friends would always just wish the winter was over. I mean, we literally would go to parking garages and ride our bikes when there's still snow on the ground to get our, you know, quote unquote fix.
Right.
You know, it's like, we're just hopping up and doing tricks on curbs, you know, not fun at all in the grand scheme of things. But when it's compared to not riding your bike at all, like that was fun to us, like right. Going to parking garages. And so we would be counting the days that winter's over, but now, yeah, it's definitely flipped.
Yeah.
Like Lou is so into like sledding and skidoo or snowmobiling or whatever that he now looks forward to the winter, which is a complete 180. So I think, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So it kind of, you know, obviously tied into the original concept of changing your mindset on the winter time.
Yeah.
And like, you know, for us going into it, maybe not necessarily loving winter, but then being around somebody who dies for the winter.
Yeah.
Like, so, but yeah, the BMX thing was like a story thread that I just wasn't expecting. Mm. And that was really fun to pull together in the edit and like kind of pull out, you know, you kind of have like the story of like this trip that's happening. Right. And, you know, okay, we're going to Newfoundland and then the trip happens and, oh, we can't do the thing. And then blah, 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 and we run out of, you know, gas and, you know, now there's weather. And then, you know, you kind of have this like arc of like the story climax and then it's kind of coming down and it's documenting what we're doing.
Right.
But then there's like the thing of like, oh, we're changing our mindset of the wintertime. And like, this is the experience that we had and the thoughts that we taken away from it. And then at the end, like, was this a good experience? And then there's like the BMX thing,
yeah,
which is like character development kind of thing.
I do also like I didn't realize it until you put it in the edit, which was, I think, masterfully done.
Oh,
when Lewis was like talking about how he was the only, I assumed that like when he took us to the sinkhole, that it was just like a common spot for him to go. And he's like seen it. It's like, you know, us taking people flying over Niagara Falls. It's like done 1,000 times.
Yeah.
But he's like, no, I've never been down here, man. I've never been able to convince anyone to come down here with me. I was like, wait, what? I just thought like this is a common thing for him to do. But he's like, no one else would come down here with me. So I've just never been down here before.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, and I was like, you just knew I'd be down for it. He's like, oh yeah. I just knew you'd be like, didn't even think twice. You'd definitely come down with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Daredevil Chris Nicholas. I think that's the funny thing is because like you are a risk taker, right? You like, you love the thrill. You can hear it as you're sliding in. You're like, fuck the rope. And you're just like dying laughing. It's the best to hear you like that because it's just like, you know, pure joy. But like, yeah, when he was like, yeah, I've never been down here. And like the way you reacted, you're like, what? And it was like, you just followed him into this hole and you were like, whatever. It's all good. Like, he's going to go. So I'll go, you
know, there's a rope. No one can go wrong.
No big deal. But it's, I think it's like a perfect testament to like the type of person that you are, where you're like willing to take calculated risks, maybe more so than me. And
but also kind of figuring it out later. Just knowing for like without,
oh, just knowing that you,
just knowing I'd be down for it.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Kind of like a testament to like us knowing each other for so long.
Yes, for sure. It's funny. Cause I think that I've been kind of talking to Lou a little bit more in the more recent years, because we have a lot in common, because we really like outdoor stuff and photography. And
oh yeah, you and Lou have way more in common now.
Yeah, like he's dabbling in photography, right? And I kind of want to learn fly fishing, so we've been kind of chatting a little bit more over the last couple of years. But it is really interesting to see like you two together and like the friendship that you have and like that bond from like your childhood. You know, things change and everybody kind of grows up, but you guys still have a really special relationship. But it was really nice to watch you guys like together.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, it was nice. Normally when we're doing trips, like you're in control. You're the person who makes the calls, the no-go decisions. What did it feel like to leave all of that up to Lewis?
It actually wasn't really that alarming at all. Mm-hmm. Like for me, like I trusted that Lewis wouldn't put us in any situations that were life-threatening.
The moment I trusted Lou was on the phone when I said something and he backed me up. And it was like a safety packs thing. And I was like, okay, I trust Lou to like make the right decisions. Like yeah. There's no red flags in our phone call that was like, I'm nervous that he's going to like, you know, push us too far or whatever. Like I got a really good, we're going to be safe. And I'm going to say, fuck this. If
we
it's
should
not
have,
good.
We should have phoned Lou up and did like,
we can do a podcast with Lou.
Yeah. But I was going to say that it's also, you never know the pressure some people might feel, especially when like you're dealing with friends, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, you can almost picture like, oh God, these guys are coming all this way to do this for the first time. They got 3 days. We got to make this work, you know? And then add on top of that, like where we offered to foot the bill basically for everything.
Yeah.
You know, fuel, accommodations. Obviously Lou was very generous in donating his time to this project.
And also like lining up the sled and the trailer and so, picking out the Airbnb.
Right. All that. Right. So yeah. Like, you know, the least we could do was pay for those things.
Yeah.
Especially when he's going to be in our film. Right.
Yeah.
But you know, he probably at some point thought there's this thing in the back of your mind. I would imagine people would very easily be like, you know, oh God, this person's paying for this and they're come expecting this experience. I don't want to let them down.
Yeah.
And that's always a tough thing in any industry. Right. I don't really want to call it industry because it's basically at the end of the day, it's just friends hanging out. But like you hear a lot with helicopter pilots. You know, you've got the pilot in the command who is oftentimes younger than the quote unquote client who's paying for the service, who's often probably a powerful, you know, well-off person. The pilot is like, oh my God, I have to say yes and have to say, make this a go decision because I might not ever get hired by this person again. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's so like, there's this power differential and pressure. So not saying it's the same with Lou and us, but he, you know, there's probably some pressure for him to make, you know, it a good trip for us, quote unquote.
I'm sure there was probably a level of anxiety for him too on like not only taking like two friends that he cares about into the backcountry, but like with our first time, like that might have been a little bit nerve wracking for him as well.
Yeah, he can't control what we're gonna do.
Yeah, or if we're gonna get hurt or like,
like if we do something stupid.
Yeah. So I know there's probably like a little bit level of that, but I think that he's like a very like safety conscious person. I got that from the phone call. And I think we were pretty clear up front, like, this is what we want to do. But like, if we can't make it, it's also okay.
Yes.
And that's something that I feel like I try to communicate with people anytime we're doing anything, you know, even when we were flying with Trent, it's like, I'm okay if we don't do this.
Yeah. Just so there's no motivation for them to push the envelope thinking that they're doing what we want them to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. But as far as your, going back to your original question of how did you feel about sort of relinquishing control about the planning and the go, no go decisions? I was fine with it.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like uncomfortable at any point. I didn't ever feel like, oh, Lou is making a decision on our behalf that I don't think is in our best interest.
Yeah.
And if there was, I would just say, listen, I'm not comfortable with this. But he also said up front too, if you guys are not comfortable with anything and I'm still comfortable with it, we'll go with like the,
yeah, you tell me and yeah, we'll go. Yeah.
Yeah. It's it, all it takes is three to go, one to know, you know, it's like they're all three of us can say, have to say go, but if one of us says no go, then that's it. The whole group doesn't go.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful when you've got a group that has that really open communication.
Yeah. That's how you know you have like a really good dynamic. And yeah, I would 100% do a trip like this again with him.
Yeah.
Round two for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe, I also maybe think fishing next time.
I also think that, you know, when you also look at the baseline for what's considered a stressful situation, you and I probably have maybe a little bit higher threshold than most people have had, just with the nature of helicopter travel, the nature of, you know, my job as a physician doing procedures on people. There's a level of intensity that, you know, it kind of reestablishes the baseline. So things that aren't necessarily...
things that might be intense for somebody else is not quite intense for us.
That's probably a nice way to say it. Like it might not blip on our radar as high as somebody who maybe doesn't have that level of adventure.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I also feel like because of our experiences with adventure that you and I have a pretty good sense of like, oh, this is a red flag.
Yeah.
Oh, this thing is happening and we need to step, like we need to take a second and be like, what is happening? Why is this happening? And like, how is this going to fuck us later?
Yes. And also too, like to your credit for the person who basically plans all of our emergency kits, plans all of our what ifs.
Yeah.
You probably went, if you look at like, take 1,000 people who went on a first time skidoo trip, compare what you brought and what you had as contingency plans to the average person, you were well above average.
Maybe. I mean, like I'm definitely no survival expert at all.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is if you take a sampling of 1,000 people who are going on their first skidoo trip,
yeah,
you were the top 1% of those people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely prepared in terms of,
because you're no stranger to danger. You're no stranger to adventure is what I was going to say.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience of like, you know, backcountry stuff, but I learned.
I mean, you do though.
I mean, I guess.
Backcountry,
I mean,
helicopter trips?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I guess when you put it like that,
the opposite of Dunning-Kruger. Like you have such little confidence in yourself and such more experience than most people.
I just like, I compare myself to the people that I watch on the internet who
are doing
the most extreme, like 50 days in a row, one year go like from the Ungava Peninsula all the way to Newfoundland. Like
that's Justin Barber. You're talking about Justin Barber.
Yeah. It's like insane. That's insane. And like, you know, you have people like Karina who's like, you know, solo female out in the woods, just overnight canoe, whatever. And I'm like, I can't do that. When I see that, I don't compare it equally to like backcountry helicopter trips or travel or whatever.
But regardless, you're in the backcountry alone. Well, with you and I.
Yeah.
Self-sufficient.
Right.
That's being out in the backcountry.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you're right.
And you've,
I just feel like such a noob. I feel like having
imposter syndrome is what will keep you alive.
Yeah. I think there's so much to talk about with Bluebird, but I definitely learned some things from that trip. I learned that we can do hard things and that our bodies, I mean, even from heading west, same thing, like our bodies can do some pretty crazy shit. But I also learned that if you're going on a vehicle, and I should have known this from the helicopter, to bring a fuel siphoning hose.
Oh.
And it's something that I think I might want to add to my truck.
Yeah, that was one of the things that we didn't really talk about. There's a line that alludes to it when I think Lou says something about she doesn't have a hose.
He said, I looked in there's no hose.
Yeah, that was basically, he meant a siphon, because we were talking about how we had a full tank of fuel. We didn't even register on the fuel gauge as being
on the expedition.
On the expedition, because it had so much fuel compared to the Polaris that he rented.
Yeah.
So we could have gotten
Voyager, I think it was called.
Yeah. We could have gotten in and out if we were able, had a method to transfer the fuel from our sled to his.
Yeah. That's it. The crazy thing is that, like, you know, I watch a lot of these like backpacking and survival videos, right? And they always talk about the 10 essentials mm-hmm. that you have to have, right? Like fix a kit, illumination, fire, da, da, da. There's like 10, I think.
You got a fancy acronym for that?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't, there's no acronym. I'm sure there is. I should look it up. But anyway.
Food, shelter, fix it.
Yeah, it's like food, fire, fix it, shelter, illumination, insulation. Anyway, there's more. But fuel, like having a fuel siphon is just not something that would be on my radar for things. And, you know, so there's like a lot of things that you can fix, but like, it's just, I lost my train of thought.
You were saying there's something you learned.
Oh yeah. So when we were out there, like the funny thing is if we had had a fuel siphon, we would have made it to the gorge.
Yes.
And it's just like one small piddly piece of kit that made the difference between us not making it and us making it. And it seems like such a straightforward piece of the kit, but it's also not, because I never thought of it. Like, why would you, you know, it's just not something you would think of, because you're like, okay, well, like this sled has this much fuel. My other sled has this much fuel. This sled also has fuel. So like, and this is a rental company renting a sled to go to the gorge. So you would think that the company would be like, oh, this sled can make it in and out, you know?
So I think that also the other piece of that was that we made a conservative decision, but I think that if memory serves correct, I think after the end of the day, Lou looked at his fuel economy and he realized that the tank float system wasn't a linear relationship of what it displayed from full to empty. Mm-hmm. So like, even though like he was burning fuel at a relatively consistent rate, the fuel gauge display was more like an S curve for the photographers.
Yeah.
And it like pushed his fuel down and he hovered in the middle for longer and then it fell off. So he says that like, it looked like it rapidly depleted initially, but then it leveled off and plateaued.
Yeah.
So he said, overall, we probably could have made it in and back, but you know, you make the decision, the best decision you have with the information you're presented with at the time.
And yes,
with the information he had at the time was that we were halfway there and his fuel was at half. We were a quarter of the way for the full trip and his fuel gauge was in half.
And it was getting later in the day and everyone was on the way out.
Right.
And those are two things that like, it's one thing, it's like you could push it if it was earlier because maybe somebody would have something.
Yeah.
But like late in the day is a red flag. Any survival story you listen to.
Yes.
It's late in the day. Mm-hmm. I decided to keep going.
Yeah.
I decided to leave my kid.
Without a key piece of equipment.
Exactly.
It was like we've listened to all these like survival podcasts and you're just like, in hindsight, when you tell the story, most of them you're like, oh, I can see exactly what's going to happen here. Oh. They're setting this up to be exactly the Swiss cheese event that I'm expecting here.
Yep.
And it's like, you end up going and making the go decision. You're leaving a piece of kit behind thinking, or you're like, oh, I'm only going to be
this long,
this far away from my camp. So I'm going to leave all my essentials at camp.
Yeah.
And then you get turned around or lost or something happens. You fall,
it's
get
late
hurt.
In the day, the sun goes down. You can't move on. It's cold. Now you're freezing. Now you're in a survival situation. It's like,
oh, and I don't have the piece of equipment that I can call people and tell them I'm in a survival situation.
Exactly.
So it becomes prolonged.
Yeah, when we lost the Garmin inReach, that was another one of those things where like we had considered abandoning it, but then it was like, what if something happens where like one of us has to leave and then we're stranded and we have no way to communicate? Because we, like I said, we're in the backcountry. It's not like when you're flying over the remote wilderness areas of Arizona and you have 4 bars of LTE.
Yes.
There is nothing. Like half the province doesn't really have good reception. You're out in the backcountry, Newfoundland, there is nothing. Like dead.
The only thing is that if you told, you'd have to rely on, you told someone where you're going
to
be.
And you
time.
Hope to fuck that they remember where you were and what time you left.
Yeah.
I was listening to a survival story the other day and it was about this guy who was riding his quad in the wintertime and he was going too fast or something happened and he ended up flipping his quad and he like landed and the quad fell on him and like completely destroyed his body. And he was there for like 3 days on the ground.
God.
And there were like wolves and like all this stuff. And he said that he told somebody that where he was going and what time he was going to be back. But because that person knew that this guy had been well trained to be in the wilderness, that they didn't really pay attention to where he was going and what time he was going back.
Oh God. Always text the person.
Well, this was,
so
I
this
think,
written,
yeah,
this
or write written. It down.
Yes.
He was supposed to be at work like a couple of days later. So he knew at least that if this person didn't send out the red flags that the guy who he worked with would probably be like, where the fuck is this guy?
Probably.
But it's a lesson, right? When you listen to all these things, it's like, it makes you really hyper aware of like what's kind of happening. And obviously mistakes still happen to people, no matter how well you're prepared. But it's another one of those things where it's like, tell people where you're going, exactly where you're going to be, when you're going to be back, write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're out there, don't deviate too far from where you're actually, where you told somebody you were going to be going.
Right.
You know, you hear also these stories of people who say they're going to the spot and they get lost, something happens and they wander 16 miles from where they were. So now people are trying to look for you in this area that you said you were.
Right.
You're no longer
there. Trying to find a needle in a haystack.
Exactly.
Well, you just reminded me of when I was a kid, I went to my cousin's cabin and he had quads, trikes, which is basically a three-wheel quad,
yep,
motorized vehicle. I was probably a young teenager and we were all riding and I wanted to continue riding. So like, all right, Chris, yeah, go take it around the trails a few times. I went alone on a trike.
Holy shit.
In the middle of the woods. I had no idea where I was. I got lost. I had to go onto the highway, find the exit to get back to their cabin.
Oh my God.
So riding this quad on the highway, I got stuck in mud. I ended up flying around a corner, flipped the trike, shot myself into the woods.
Jesus.
I was fine. I got up and flipped the trike back over and just kept going.
How old are you?
15, 16 maybe.
Holy shit.
But I'm thinking like, holy shit. Like now thinking back on that, my parents were very risk averse parents and like very like strict.
Yeah.
How the fuck did they let me do that?
That's shocking.
That is shocking to me. I still don't understand. They just let me go off on a trike. Like I have no experience on that motorized vehicle.
Were your parents there?
Yeah.
They were?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man. It's scary. It's funny when you're doing these things. It's like you can't be too afraid that you're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
But you had to still have this like healthy level of fear so that you become prepared and that you can kind of recognize things that could be potential dangers. Obviously mistakes happen. Obviously accidents happen. But like when you're going out into the backcountry of Newfoundland for the first time on a sled, you try to be as prepared as possible. And yeah. I think it's one of those things where like you're packing up the sled and you're hoping for a really good day, but you know, you might be bringing a couple of extra bottles of water just in case. You're bringing that fire kit just in case. You might have a tarp in there just in case. You know, you're making sure that like,
the bivy bag.
Yeah, bivy bag. You know, it's going to be a sunny day, but you're going to throw your fleece in the back as well and a couple extra layers just in case, right?
Yep.
And so suddenly your kit ends up being a lot larger than it probably should. And I think that's a lot of the reasons why in some of these situations where people do leave part of their kit at their camp when they wander away because it's heavy.
Yeah, but nobody's planning on ever needing any of that stuff.
No, exactly.
That's the thing. That's the cruel catch 22 of it all, right?
Yeah.
It's like 99.999% of the time, you're never going to need any of this stuff. So it's like, you're going to burden, and you may never need it in your life.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I could just never bring this stuff and I could just be a lot easier trips for the rest of my life. Or I could bring them every trip for the one chance that this happens. It's like
our survival kit that we bring in the helicopter all the time.
Yeah.
Takes up an entire under the seat compartment.
Yeah. But it's an interesting concept of number needed to treat. It's like how many times you need to intervene to save one life.
Mm.
And like, that's like a concept in medicine where you're talking about drugs and it's like, oh, the number needed to treat for this drug is 1,000. So out of 1,000 people that take this medication, only one person is going to really benefit from it.
Right.
But it might save that person's life.
Right.
And so you extrapolate that or apply it to the concept of survival in like our situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the number needed to treat or the number needed to like save us one time may never happen in our lifetime.
Right.
But if it does, you're going to be thankful you had those extra layers.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Gosh, that's crazy. Well, we didn't get lost. We didn't get hurt. There were no accidents. We only tipped over once and almost fell into the river. That was a near miss. We almost fell into a creek river.
Yeah, it would have
been
fine.
We did not. Actually, when we fell over, I had to take a second because the sled kind of fell on me.
Mm-hmm.
But like not fully.
The 700-pound skidoo.
Yeah, but not fully. And like as we fell, like hit the ground, I had to take a second. I didn't get knocked out, but I was just like, am I hurt?
Yeah, you did like a full body scan.
I was like, my leg is underneath the skidoo. Like, am I hurt?
Thankfully, and the snow was pretty soft.
Pretty soft, yeah. And like the sled, where it was like on a hill, like I kind of slipped off. So it was like my boot was just kind of like underneath, but the sled wasn't fully like on it.
And it was a very low impact thing. It was like it was a technical turn. We were trying to like go along like a thin area and there was a bump that's going one way and
it
we were
was
trying
really
to turn
steep,
the other way.
Yeah, and we just kind of
we were only going over. Really slow though.
Yeah, so we were fine. But yeah, I mean, it's a bit shocking, right?
Yeah.
It was your first experience. But anyway, I think overall I had a fantastic time. Really had a good time with you. I had a really good time with Lewis, even though it was pretty, you know, scary at times, but great.
Would you do it again?
Definitely. Would you?
Oh yeah, for sure. We get into the gorge next time.
Yes, definitely.
We got to get into the gorge next time.
I hope so.
Lewis also planted the seed about like this cabin that he says is out in the middle of nowhere where you can like rent the whole cabin and the capacity is like 10 guests.
Really?
And you could basically skidoo out to the cabin. stay in the backcountry, and they'll provide like a full staff of like caterers basically to like cater the stay.
That'd be pretty sweet.
But you'd have to do it with a group to make it like economically feasible.
Sounds expensive.
Yeah.
Speaking of expensive, when are we going to get our own Skidoo?
Interestingly, I had a talk with a coworker, Gary, about that today.
Today?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Gary said, Gary, who works with me.
Gary, who has an off-road vehicle who I've been trying to get on the go for camping.
Yeah. Gary, who grew up very outdoorsy and has all the same interests as us, particularly Becky. He was basically saying, because he used to own a Skidoo, and he said he sold it because it just didn't make sense. He was like, here, man. He's like, Doc, listen, here, how many months of winter do you get? Look out right now. It's early January. We have had one snow. The ground isn't even frozen.
Yeah.
So like the 2 months you get, the ground might not even be frozen when you're going out, and it just turns into mud.
He's right. I feel like if we were going up to like Northern Canada,
yep.
Like, yeah, that would make sense. Like Muskoka area up in the Crown Land.
Yep.
I could almost see a scenario where you have like a 2-man sled, kind of like Lou's expedition that we were mm-hmm. riding, with like a sled on the back that you could carry a canvas hot tent and a wood stove and mm-hmm. then kind of.
Oh, she sought this out already.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have. Like, you go in, you set up your tent, maybe you home base there, you know, frig around a little bit, maybe you move again, or just like, maybe it's just skidooing a couple kilometers into the wilderness and setting up tents and, you know, doing that and then skidooing out. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like, there's just not enough snow to justify the cost.
Yeah.
If
you're using them 5 to 6 months a year, yeah, great. But he was telling me, he was like, he's even seeing a change in our climate just from his winters growing up as a kid here.
Really?
And he was telling me, he was like, yeah, like I'd be able to use my Skidoo like 4 or 5 months out of the year. Like I would Skidoo to like places, like to go to the store, to go to get breakfast, to go to, he had a bunch of his buddies who would go on trails and they'd spend the Saturdays just going around and they'd cover hundreds of miles.
Wow.
And he was like, those were like the golden days. But he's like, now like the winters are so mild.
Wow.
That it just doesn't make sense to spend. And also the prices have changed too. Like he was like, you used to be able to buy like a top line Skidoo for $8,000.
Yeah. They're like 20 like, or 30 grand now.
Yeah. And he's like, now you're spending as much as you would on a car, like $25,000 to get like to top line Skidoo. He's like, that just doesn't make sense to have 2 crappy months.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, for sure. And I mean, even if you were like, oh, we'll go to Canada, that's still, I need a trailer, and then you're going 4 hours right. at least.
It's like the whole thing where we were talking about, like, okay, if we want to buy land somewhere, do we want to buy it how far away from our house? Do we want to be close? Do we want to be far?
Yeah.
And that's always the case. It's like, yeah, you want to be out there, but also, like, you're going to use it less if you're 5 hours away.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if we want to go skidooing again, we can go back to Newfoundland, call up Lou, and they pretty much have snow until June. So.
Yes, bye.
All right. Well, I think we're going to end it there. It's 39 minutes on the clock. Thank you guys so much for watching. If you want to watch our movie, we will leave it in the description of this podcast and also on our show notes, beckyandchris.com/podcast, whatever episode number this is. And yeah, let us know, I guess, on Twitter or at Threads, wherever, if you have any more things that you'd like us to talk about. And we'll make another podcast.
All right, bye.